Radioactive contamination of the Pacific Ocean. The global impacts of methane and Arctic warming. The Pentagon and NATO encirclement of Russia and China. The world's indigenous games as cover for anti-indigenous legislation in Brazil. The coercive sterilization of indigenous women in Canada. Why are these and other stories not getting enough attention in the media? What were the major events of 2015, and what impacts will they have going into 2016? On this week's Global Research News Hour, the last regular show for 2015, we will examine some of the most important underreported stories of the year. We'll be joined by John Chertow of intercontinentalcry.org, Andy Lee Roth of the media initiative Project Censored, and by commentator, author, and retired Bartle Professor of Sociology, James Petrus. On this week's program, 2015, reviewing the most important and the most censored stories of the year. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 18th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. President Putin has been clear. Russia will use nuclear weapons if necessary, if conventional forces are threatened. If Ankara opts for a suicide mission of knocking out yet another Su-24 or Su-34, Russia will simply clear the airspace all across the border via the S-400s. If Ankara, under the cover of NATO, responds by launching the Turkish army on Russian positions, Russia will use nuclear missiles, drawing NATO into war not only in Syria, but potentially also in Europe. And this would include using nuclear missiles to keep Russian strategic use of the Bosphorus open. That's how we can draw a parallel of Syria today as the equivalent of Sarajevo 1914. That comes from the article, You Want War? Russia is Ready for War, by Pepe Escobar, posted December 16th, originally appearing at Sputnik News. The Western narrative currently tries to show that it is Russia, and only Russia, which is keeping Assad in power. But this is completely false. The reality is that both Hezbollah and Iran are fully committed to preventing Daesh from overthrowing the Syrian government, and their commitment has gone way further than words. Hezbollah has sent hundreds of its best fighters to Syria, and Iran has committed thousands of soldiers, mostly of the Al-Quds Brigade, to the war in Syria. What this level of determination shows is that, just like Russia, Iran and Hezbollah have concluded that their vital existential interests are at risk and that they have no choice than to take the fight to Daesh. I believe that this assessment is absolutely correct. That comes from the article, Week 10 of Russia's Intervention in Syria, The Empire's Reckless Arrogance, by The Saker, posted December 16th, originally appearing at the UNZ Review. The continued reliance on the neoliberal model of structural reform within the framework of a post-Washington consensus on the need to bring the state back into the development process, together with the turn towards and a continued reliance on extractive capital, resource-seeking FDI, constitutes serious economic, social, and political problems for Latin American states seeking to break away from the dictates of global capital and the clutches of imperial power. However, the turn of the state in Latin America towards regulation in regard to the operations of extractive capital, as well as the growing popular resistance and opposition to their destructive and negative socio-environmental impacts of these operations, also constitute major problems for global capital. The difference is that the capitalists and companies that operate in the extractive sector are able to count on the support and massive resources and powers of the imperialist state. In regard to the issue of regulation, the states and international organizations that constitute imperialism have been able to mobilize their considerable resources and exercise their extensive powers to create a system of corporate self-regulation in the form of a doctrine of a corporate social responsibility doctrine. With this doctrine, the Latin American states that have turned to or resorted to a strategy of natural resource development have been under tremendous pressure to allow the companies that operate in the extractive sector to regulate themselves. That comes from the article Imperialism and Capitalism: Rethinking an Intimate Relationship, by Professor James Petrus and Professor Henry Veltmeyer, posted December 16th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The website intercontinentalcry.org has, for the last decade, served as a hub of cutting-edge news and analysis of issues affecting and facing the more than 6,000 indigenous nations worldwide. Joining us now to talk about some of the world's major underreported indigenous stories of 2015 is John Anawanka Shurto. He's the founder of Intercontinental Cry. So thank you very much for joining us, John.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Okay, so you did flag a few stories, and I'll just try. We'll just go through a few of them. Here's a major one: the Real World Indigenous Games in Brazil. Brazil approves major anti-indigenous legislation while the media keeps us entertained. And this is in reference to the anti-indigenous legislation in question is the PEC 215. So, do you want to maybe just give us a bit of background about what that story was all about?
Well, just to clarify, PEC is the Portuguese abbreviation for a proposed constitutional amendment, and this particular piece of legislation has been opposed extensively by indigenous peoples in Brazil for over 2 years. They've been trying to stop this law from being approved because it would give Congress unprecedented powers to control indigenous borders. So they could erase them or change them as they see fit without any consultation. So, you know, there's been a huge movement to stop this from moving forward. But the Indigenous Games, it turned out, while the media was going on and on and on about, you know, how amazing the games were and how beautiful all these indigenous women were, you know, there was pageants with indigenous women showing off traditional regalia, and you know, the mainstream media covered it extensively. You know, they were just loving every minute of it, right? And in the midst of this, while Brazil was going on and on and on about how wonderful it is and how everybody in the world should come there and spend their money and blah blah blah, Congress slipped this bill in and gave it an approval. Despite the fact that just, you know, a few months prior, Congress promised Brazil's indigenous people that they would throw this bill into the garbage. And there was actually a huge celebration about it. But that's only, you know, the tip of the iceberg. There was a bunch of unfortunate happenings taking place in Brazil during the games that nobody actually covered. As far as I know, IC was the first publication in North America to actually expose what was happening inside the games. There was some several protests that took place opposing the...
There were massive mobilizations, were there not?
I wouldn't say massive, but there were numerous protests, and, you know, like television networks kind of flashed over it here and there, and there were maybe a couple dozen articles, not even that many. But there were also, you know, several difficulties reported by the indigenous volunteers who were taking part in the games. According to several of the volunteers, they were basically treated like slaves. They were given one meal a day. you know, they were literally being starved. They had no access to water. They were sleeping on cement, you know, in the, you know, working full time under the boiling sun with no access to air-conditioned zones. Even though there were air-conditioned areas there, the organizers weren't letting the indigenous peoples go into those areas. Mm-hmm. So they're like, they're basically being tortured practically.
And yeah, there's unsafe working conditions and risk involved too, eh?
Yeah, and there were, you know, reports of ceiling collapse as well, just all sorts of problems, dehydration, people were suffering from dehydration, and journalists apparently were told that they weren't allowed to talk about this. They weren't allowed to say anything bad about the games. And as a result, I guess everybody bowed to that threat and kept silent about it. Mm-hmm. So throughout the games, everybody was smiling and also happy about everything that was oh so perfect. Meanwhile, you know, there's all this stuff happening behind the scenes that nobody covered.
Interesting. And this all seemed to be servicing group of people that might be smiling in particular, I imagine, would be the agribusiness companies.
Well, and Brazilian Congress, because at this point, like, there's like Brazil's agribusiness lobby is extremely powerful. They're also specific segments of the lobby is militarized and extremely racist. You know, they're well known for organizing anti-indigenous campaigns. The president of Brazil works hand in hand with. One woman, I can't recall her name, but she's known as the Chainsaw Queen. So they're working hand in hand with Congress and the agribusiness lobby to, you know, undermine indigenous rights. And there are actually about a half a dozen different ministerial orders and proposed constitutional amendments in Brazil, all targeting indigenous land rights and environmental protections in Brazil, much like the suite of legislation that Harper pushed forward here in Canada just prior to the launch of Vital No More. It's the same thing happening in Brazil. And PEC 215 has been the main focus because that's the imminent threat right now. And, you know, I can't see the indigenous peoples in Brazil taking this sitting down. When the bill was first proposed in 2013, 700 indigenous leaders occupied Brazil's House of Representatives. You know, they stormed it, forcing Brazil's Congress to refuse to push it forward, which is ultimately why I imagine that the games were used to get the to quietly push the bill forward. But they're not going to let it go through. Mm. There's just no chance.
Okay. Another story, just to move along to, because there are a lot of other very important stories, I want to make sure people get a bit of a representative sampling. You've got another story here. This is by contributor France Rivet about 8 Labrador Inuit who were brought over to Europe about 136 or 34 years ago. Or 136 years ago, and their remains remain there, and they were essentially trapped in a human zoo for exhibition from people out there. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that story there?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's actually France Reveille. She's the author of a book called In the Footsteps of Abraham Alcarab, the events of 1880 to 1881. France has actually been instrumental in the effort to bring the remains of the Inuit home. So, like, the story starts in 1880 during, you know, in the midst of Canada's war of attrition against Indigenous peoples, where everyone here is basically being, you know, divided, segregated, and starved to death. And in the midst of this, a Norwegian ethnologist approached Abraham, who had been converted to Protestantism by the Moravian Church, offered to take Abraham and his family to Europe to demonstrate their way of life to the public in exchange for money. Now, this was probably a hard decision for Abraham, but he ultimately decided that, you know, it was an opportunity for him to provide some relief for his family. So he decided to go. And with him, he took his wife, their two daughters, a single man from Hebron, Labrador, and a traditional Inuit family of three. And, you know, soon after his arrival in Germany, they quickly, Abraham quickly realized that they should not have gone on this journey. You know, they were extremely homesick. But, you know, things got worse just after a month or so. After spending their days being exhibited in Berlin, Prague, Prague, Frankfurt, and Darmstadt, the first of many tragedies struck when one of the Inuit, Nugsak, who's aged 15, suddenly and unexpectedly died. The doctors, you know, thought she had a stomach ulcer, and then so, you know, everybody mourned her loss, and they kind of just moved on. But then just 9 days later, Nugasak's mother suddenly fell ill with the same symptoms. 4 days after that, the youngest of the group, age three, Abraham's daughter, sorry, she's not the youngest, the second youngest, you know, started getting sick as well. And then suddenly the doctors realized that they were dealing with smallpox. By January 16th, they were all dead. And from that point on, basically, the this story essentially ends. The Inuit's belongings were sent home along with a diary that Abraham kept during their journey. But then, you know, nobody really heard about this story again until really 1980, when a Canadian ethnologist discovered a copy of Abraham's diary. 25 years after that, the diary was translated to English. And in more recent times, in 2009, France discovered the story, and she asked a question that nobody had ever answered. What happened to the remains? So after a year of investigation, she'd found that the remains were actually in Paris. And France, being from France, the you know, took this as a sign that that she needed to take this on, and ever since then she's been working as the go-between between Germany, France, Canadian government, and the government of Nunavut to bring everyone's remains home. Mm-hmm. And this is an ongoing story. In fact, the official request for the repatriation of the remains could literally come tomorrow. Story is unfolding as we speak, and there's a documentary film forthcoming as well called "Trapped in a Human Zoo." And I'm not sure when it's going to be released, but it's supposed to be airing on the CBC's Nature of Things.
Yes, it was supposed to happen this month, I think.
Yeah, November or December was when it was originally scheduled, but there's been some kind of delay. it's definitely on the way, though. And if people want to be updated about this, you know, they can keep an eye on IC because we're gonna put a spotlight on it as soon as it's out.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to bring up just one more story because, it's just hot off the press, I guess you might say.
Yep.
And this is with regard to the sterilization of Indigenous women. And this is an act of genocide. It just came out the day that we're having this conversation. It's called An Act of Genocide, Canada's Coerced Sterilization of First Nations Women. And I think that where there have been references to this in the mainstream, I think there was a CBC story about it, but it doesn't really provide much context. And it would be easy to just kind of dismiss it as just you get to the systemic aspects of this. Maybe you should – I'll let you expand on the main elements of this story that really need to be addressed.
Yeah, well, this situation has been systemically ignored by everybody. I first became extremely aware of Canada's history of sterilization about 15 years ago. It was the first story that I ever investigated when I got access to the internet. Since then, I've been keeping an eye out for coverage on this, and the world was basically silent until this year, when Dr. Karen Stout published a book called An Act of Genocide, and it focuses particularly on sterilization of Indigenous women in Ontario. What I noticed in all the coverage of Karen Stout's book and the interviews that she carried out was that nobody pointed out the fact that there were actually two pieces of sterilization legislation in Canada in the, I'm not sure the exact date, 1900s, early 1900s, just before, actually, the Nazis passed the Nuremberg race laws that outlined the German Jews from having sexual or marital relations with anyone of German or mixed ancestry. Two provinces passed sterilization legislation. Alberta, in 1928 here, called the Sexual Sterilization Act. And then 5 years later, 1933, BC passed the Act Respecting Sexual Sterilization. And it didn't explicitly mention targeting Indigenous women or immigrants, but it has to be understood that there was a massive eugenics movement going on back then, and protecting the Anglo-Saxon race was a major reason for it. It's kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, understood that the undesirable traits that are mentioned in the legislation includes skin color. The problem is that because, one, this has been so completely ignored, two, it has been... there's been no real research into this history. We don't actually know how many Indigenous women, men, and children were sterilized in Canada. CBC's coverage should send off alarms across the board that not only is this being ignored, but this is an ongoing issue. It's not just something that happened, 60 years ago. Not that that's even reason to ignore it, because it's not. Like so much of Canada's history that's been, you know, fundamentally suppressed intentionally, you know, we have to start considering this. We have to investigate it. There are inquiries that are needed, much like the inquiry for murdered and missing Indigenous women and the work that has gone into exposing and quote-unquote reconciling everything that happened during residential schools. You know, these men, women, and children who were biologically disabled by the government in cooperation with the church needs to be addressed. And in order to address that, we need to, one, start stepping up. We need to start talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, it's especially important that this report is coming out just at the time where the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's final report is being released, and the Liberal government is reissuing the apology for the residential school crisis, and there's been a lot of messaging about how we've got to resolve the situation in a proper and respectful manner. So, I mean, I think that your website and the stories that come out through intercontinentalcry.org provides a very important and crucial context for all of this. I know we're kind of running at the end of our scheduled time, but I really wanted to put a question to you about, your thoughts after all these years of covering these stories and seeing them suppressed or ignored, even by a lot of indie media outlets. What are your thoughts about why that's happening? Is this garden variety racism or something more insidious?
Well, I've been asking myself that question for 10 solid years. I started IC precisely because of this. I didn't really grasp the reasons until recently, at least to an extent that I'm satisfied with. I'm not sure it's insidious, maybe in some cases. In the case of the mainstream's coverage or non-coverage of indigenous struggles against mining, oil, hydro, and so forth, I'm sure there's a less than righteous agenda going on there. But I think there's really a collection of factors for the marginalization of indigenous peoples in the media. I'll just mention them quickly here. The first is the differences in language. This doesn't really pertain to journalists and indigenous peoples in Canada, but worldwide there's definitely a massive barrier there. The cost of authoring articles is another major factor, especially when it comes to independent media. With the limited coverage that most independent publications have, we all have to be quite selective about what we take on. And 9.9 times out of 10, independent publications are going to choose something local, something that's going to bring something more to them. And indigenous peoples usually don't enter into that picture. Another major factor is culture. The fact that colonial culture is a culture of guilt, doubt, blame, shame, denial, and fear. And there are many points of justification that people use to avoid speaking out and telling stories and doing something of substance to support indigenous peoples. And then, of course, there is the ever-present conflicts of interest, especially pertaining to corporate media. They don't want to talk much about Barrick Gold's adventures in Papua New Guinea and the systemic abuse and rape of indigenous women there. But the list could go on for hours. Conflict of interest is a massive factor there.
Okay, so listeners, if you're interested in hearing more about these sorts of stories, just please remember to go to intercontinentalcry.org and just to point out that there is a fundraiser going on till the end of December, and they're trying to raise money to help keep Intercontinental Cry a valuable resource. So that URL again is intercontinentalcry.org. So John Anawanka Shirto, thank you very much for sharing this time and sharing those stories with us, and we hope to interview you again in 2016.
Certainly, I look forward to it.
John Anawanka Shirto is the founder of intercontinentalcry.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The media literacy initiative known as Project Censored has been active chronicling and assembling the most underreported important stories of the previous year. Censored 2016 is releasing its list of the top 25 most censored stories of 2014 to 2015. And here to discuss those stories is one of Project Censored's editors, Andy Lee Roth. So, Andy, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to join you, Michael. Yes.
So, first of all, can you tell us about the methodology that you employ?
Well, the kind of hunting for, identifying, and then ultimately vetting and ranking our top 25 story list each year is really a year-round process. It involves a huge collection of people. This year's list is the represents the combined efforts of some 191 undergraduate students from 18 college and university campuses across the U.S. and Canada, 31 faculty members at those institutions, and another, I believe it's nine community experts. The faculty and the community experts act as evaluators of the students' summaries of the stories and their analyses of whether stories have received corporate coverage. When that process, which goes on for about 9 months of the year, is complete, we send off, we vote to whittle down what's approximately 200 to 300 stories, depending on the year. We whittle those down to a list of about 30, and then those are sent in the early spring to our panel of 28 international judges who actually vote to rank order the stories as they appear in the top 25 list in the book each year and on our website.
I've noticed that year after year, there are certain sorts of themes, or call them bureaus, if you will, that where you see representation on the environmental catastrophe front. You see representation in terms of police state surveillance kinds of stories and economic stories. And it seems to me even sort of like a positive stories or two about community resistance. Is that do you have to curate these stories in a way that you get some representation in each of those areas, or does it just naturally fall into place like that?
That's not a conscious effort, but it's interesting. I think you're quite right that there are kind of these recurrent themes. I like your idea of almost bureaus, although there are bureaus that arise not completely by happenstance, but they aren't a conscious effort on our part in terms of curating. I think those are, as you've mentioned, the kind of economic inequality, challenges to the integrity of our environment, the threats to civil liberties and the like. These are the core kind of, I'm speaking now as a sociologist, these are sort of core social problems that don't go away. There is continuity even as we each year try to bring forward distinct stories that that are worthy of greater attention than they're getting in the corporate media.
Let's talk about a few of those stories. So you got in the number one position a story. It's called "Half of Global Wealth Owned by the 1%," and you were one of the you were the faculty evaluators for this story. It's in relation to an Oxfam report that came out in January 2015. Do you want to maybe touch on some of the key elements of that story?
Yeah, and I'll use this as a chance very quickly to just give a shout out. Each of these stories is of course originally reported by an independent reporter and published or presented by an independent news outlet. But students at Project Censored in Project Censored classes, and so in this case, a shout out to former students of mine, Izzy Michelson from Pitzer College and Ina Tunkel from Scripps College, are the ones who do the initial research on these. So they dug this story and found the Oxfam report that you mentioned. The Oxfam report focused on extreme inequality, as is, I think, fairly well covered in the corporate press. But what the Oxfam report, what Izzy and Ina, as they compared the independent news coverage that we have from sources like The Guardian and Oxfam's own report, what they found was that the independent news coverage was emphasizing aspects of the Oxfam report that the corporate media were ignoring, specifically the Oxfam report emphasizing that extreme economic inequality is not inevitable, but is the result of political choices and economic policies that are established and maintained by a kind of power elite. And the Oxfam report laid out a very clear 9-point plan that governments could adopt to address poverty and income inequality. And this aspect, too, when Izzy Michelson and Nina Tunkel, the students who took on this story and researched it, what they found was that in the corporate news, although the Oxfam report got some coverage, that aspect of the report, the solutions part of it, was completely elided. It was overlooked.
I want to bring up another story. This is number 5, the Fukushima nuclear disaster deepens. And I took note of it because, you know, global research is one of the contributors to that,
Michelle Sosudovsky's Fukushima Endgame story that came out at the end of 2014 is one of three stories that comprise our number 5 story. One of the key things here is if we take the official perspective, the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency has commended Japan for making significant progress in cleaning up the Fukushima site. There have been assurances in the corporate media from government authorities and the major news media themselves that the situation is contained and improvement is ongoing. But what we're starting to see, and I can update this even from what we published, Sensor 2016 came out in October of this year. We went to press with our great publisher, Seven Stories Press, earlier in the summer. And since then, what we're starting to see in October, we're starting to see the first peer-reviewed journal articles showing increased incidences of thyroid cancer in Fukushima Prefecture, incident rates that are 20 to 50 times the national level among people who are 18 years or younger. We know how we understand radiation contamination that it affects younger people first and more powerfully. We also have had, since the book went to press, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, responsible for the operation of the Fukushima plants, has acknowledged that the first employee was leukemia. So we're starting to see what skeptics had predicted in the immediate aftermath of the Fukushima disaster. We're starting to see some of the long-term health consequences come to rise.
Now, there's another story that I really wanted you to touch on because it comes on the heels of this big COP21 conference. Well, we are having this interview on the heels of the completion of the COP21 conference, and this is number 6, Methane and Arctic Warming's Global Impacts, and that's based on a story for Truth out by an outstanding independent journalist, Darja Mail, and it's the story, The Methane Monster Roars, from January 2015.
Yes, he does such great work in covering environmental issues, and this story is an exemplar of that. In Paris, when methane was discussed, it was discussed in the context of things like the fracking of natural gas and oil. And there are important points there that need to be addressed. What Jamail is talking about is not Arctic gas, not methane gas that is being released directly by human activity, but the release of and the potentially enormous catastrophic releases of methane gas that would result indirectly from human activity. Mm. So as Arctic ice melts, trapped methane is released into the atmosphere. And as one of the scientists, Jamail, talks with quips, it's not Vegas, but the Arctic. What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. And one of the things that Jamail focuses on in his Truth Out report is the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. It covers some million square kilometers, and each year it releases about 17 million tons of methane into the atmosphere. This is as a result of Arctic warming. But an earlier study, a 2013 study that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature, reported that there's the possibility of a 50 gigaton burp of methane gas, and that this possibility was fairly likely. And Jermel, to put that in perspective for us, a 50 gigaton burp of methane released in a very short time frame would be the equivalent of at least 100 gigatons of carbon dioxide. Now, since 1850, to put that in historical perspective, humans have released a total of approximately 1,475 gigatons of CO2. So to release in a single, you know, burp is the term that's actually used in this Nature article from 2013, to release a 50 gigaton burp of methane that would be the equivalent to almost two-thirds of the carbon dioxide we've released into the atmosphere in the last 160-some years would be a tremendous alteration of our atmosphere, and would have that would lead to temperature increases of 4 to 6 degrees Celsius in just a couple of decades, a rapid rate of climate change that things like human agriculture and ecosystems more generally would have a very difficult, if not impossible, time adapting to.
Yeah.
So that kind of concern was apparently not even on the table or up for discussion in Paris.
Yeah, this year's Censored has a number of fascinating stories here. I mean, there's global killing of environmentalists rises dramatically. The new Amazon of the North, Canadian deforestation. Pentagon and NATO encircle Russia and China. What can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. This is and this shows you the extent to which we're trying to dig to sources that are important but not readily known. This is a piece by Bruce Gagnon that was published in the Plymouth Institute for Peace Research in August of 2014. Basically, Gagnon's argument is that we can interpret what the Pentagon and NATO are doing with regard to Russia and China as efforts in service of corporate capital, and corporate capital's vested interests in the regions, in the two regions' natural resources. So he's identifying things like the U.S. military bases in Romania and Bulgaria, plans for additional bases in Albania as efforts to surround or Russia. NATO similarly expanding into Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, with talk that there might be additional countries, that Georgia, Sweden, Finland, perhaps even the Ukraine would join NATO. And these he understands in line with comments by General James Jones, who was the Supreme Allied Commando of NATO in 2006. Jones commented that NATO deployment was designed to, quote, safeguard oil and gas fields in the Caspian Sea region. And there's a similar kind of argument with regard to China. The U.S. Navy regularly patrols seas outside of China's boundaries with destroyers that have missile capabilities. There are ground-based missile defense systems in South Korea, as well as those located at bases in Hawaii, Japan, Guam, Taiwan, Australia, and the Philippines. And so, you know, there's much more to this story, but that gives a sense, I think, of the kind of the big picture that Gagnon is taking in this article. And again, it's something that we don't see. We don't see that kind of macro view. Even if you scanned the paper or watched the news online, you might get bits and pieces of this, but it's kind of the connecting the dots to see, to interpret how it gives us a bigger picture is something that's been missing.
Andy Lieb-Roth, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's a pleasure.
And Andy Lieb-Roth is one of the editors with Project Censored. You can go to the website projectcensored.org to get the lowdown and the breakdown of all of the major underreported stories of the past several years. We're joined right now by James Petras. He is the retired Bartle Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York, and adjunct professor at St. Mary's University, Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Canada. He's the author of over 62 books, has authored more than 600 articles in professional journals and over 2,000 articles in non-professional journals, including The New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, New Left Review, and Global Research. He joins us now by phone. So it's a pleasure to have you back on the Global Research News Hour, Professor Petrus.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's always a pleasure working with you folks and collaborating with Michelle Chosudovsky and other people at the at your center.
Now, let's talk first a bit. We're coming to the end of 2015, and there have been a number of very interesting developments over the course of the last year. We've had, of course, the election of this Syriza government in Greece, the world economic crisis, the recent defeat of the Chavistas in Venezuela, the Russian military airstrikes against ISIS, the Corbyn victory in the UK, Netanyahu's victory in Israel, Black Lives Matter, the Paris bombings, and the Iranian nuclear deal. So I'm wondering if there's anything in that list or maybe things that I haven't mentioned yet that really stand out for you as having been a particularly pivotal moment of this past year.
Well, you enumerated some of the mixed results for the year. I would say overall the 2015 had a negative picture overall. Despite some positive developments, I think we can run down quickly what I think are the positive developments. I think the Russian invitation by the Syrian government is a very positive development because Russia really put the squeeze on ISIS, bombing its oil shipments, which are one of the major sources of funding, and in general providing some support, significant support in the fight against terrorism. I think in part that is a expression of Russia's geopolitical interest, but also the fact that many of the terrorists come from the Caucasus, in particular Chechnyans, who then pick up their arms and skills going back to Russia to engage in terrorist activity. And all of this is tied in with the identification of Turkey as the main conduit for money, oil sales, and arms for the terrorists. And I think this is has gradually penetrated public opinion. The second point that I think was positive was Corbyn's victory in the Labour Party. I think it's symbolic that the grassroots in England, the grassroots of the Labour Party, diverges very significantly from its parliamentary leadership, and they were able to elect Corbyn. But I think his capacity to take the Labour Party in a different direction will require a drastic change in the composition of the Labour Party representatives in the Parliament. And even his so-called shadow cabinet is infested with warmongers and a pretty reactionary bunch of right-wing social democrats. The main positive developments in the Western Hemisphere essentially is the U.S. Opening up relations with Cuba, Cuba and the U.S. signing off on a number of protocols and changes. Just today, the agreement to start commercial flights directly from the U.S. to Cuba, and gradually the distension in relations is a step in the right direction, though the U.S. still hasn't lifted the economic blockade of Cuba.
What is another pivotal event of the past year that you...
Well, I think there's three that I can mention. One is the deal with Iran, the nuclear deal for ending the embargo. I think that's positive. It bucked the pressure from the Israeli lobby in the U.S., which was for war with Iran rather than peace and a settlement. So that was a major breakthrough that we didn't go to, into another war mode, and the fact that the Israeli lobby, which up to recently had total control over U.S. Middle Eastern policy, was dealt a severe setback, at least temporarily. I think that's a big step. Anytime you defeat the Israeli warmongers, you have to say that that's a benchmark. The other thing that I noticed that I thought was significant was the Pope's statement on Earth warming, his attacks on neoliberal capitalism, what he calls savage capitalism, the dung of the devil, as he referred to it in a picturesque phrase. I think his speaking out for social justice sets a new a framework for which the Christian leaders play a positive role rather than backing warmongers and aggression. And finally, I think an ambiguous step forward was the whole discussion and recognition worldwide of climate change and that it's human causation, that it's usually overlooked, and particularly in the U.S., where the Congress still refuses to recognize climate change, and as induced by the U.S. and other countries. However, I must say that the lack of any enforcement mechanism, and the fact that the U.S. Congress is bucking any regulations, makes it a more symbolic change. And I think the defeat of Harper, though Trudeau is not any great shakes, the fact that a right-wing extremist like Harper was defeated shows at least some limitations on right-wing extremism in North America. These positive developments have to be set against what I think is a very powerful negative current that developed throughout the year. I think the fact that the U.S. is patrolling the Chinese frontier, maritime areas, I think this is a very negative development and has implications for a possible global war, the U.S. refusing to recognize China as a co-equal and using its military muscle to try to limit China's role in the world economy, and particularly the setting up of this Trans-Pacific treaty excluding China. I think these are all belligerent and negative developments on a worldwide scale. I think other issues are like the boycott of Russia, which is a very negative factor because Russia supported the Democratic Federalists in eastern Ukraine and opposed the seizure of power in Kiev. This boycott, of course, has a two-way street. It negatively impacts on trading relations between Europe and Russia. It harms both sides and is not warranted. They should sit down and arrange a democratic settlement of recognizing Ukrainian democratic aspirations and linguistic pluralism. And also allow for the eastern Ukrainians to have greater self-government. And the fact that they're boycotting Russia and building up military installations on Russia's border is also a threat to world peace. The other issues that I think are important is the right-wing victories in Argentina and Venezuela and the push to impeach the elected government in Brazil, the government of Dilma Rousseff. These right-wing victories are a threat to all of the social gains that were accumulated in these countries in the past decade and a half. And I think they will lead to severe conflict and hopefully not violence. But if these new governments begin to try to roll back social legislation, wage gains, etc., there's going to be very virulent resistance from the organized trade union movements, the neighborhoods, etc. And this is a very negative development. The big bad news in Europe, I would say, is the collapse of Syriza into a collaborator with the European Union, voted them in on the basis that they would not impose massive privatizations and even greater deprivation on the population. Instead, they signed off on an agreement which is worse than existed under the previous right-wing governments, and this undermined the left-wing cycle that was developing in Portugal and Spain. We see now that Podemos, the other left-wing group in Spain, has moved toward the center and lost support, by the way. And we see that the left in Portugal has joined with the right-wing social democrats in a coalition, so that great hopes that people had in the new left in southern Europe, it seems to me, a much more dubious proposition.
Finally, I just wanted to see what, given all those developments, if you'd care to suggest what they bode going into 2016. What do you think we can look forward to?
Well, I think this political spectrum has moved in a zigzag way, but it's moving more to the right. I think the U.S. election is a signpost here, with the Trump likely being the right-wing extremist candidate for the Republican Party, and Hillary Clinton, notorious warmonger and Israel firster, being the nominee from the Democratic Party. I think this is a poor set of choices, and I think that's not, doesn't bode well for peace and justice, not only in the United States but worldwide. The second thing I think that one can say is that there'll be intensifying social conflict and regression in economic terms in Latin America. We're going to see a lot more of class warfare and polarization in Venezuela and elsewhere, which were relatively peaceful, developing center-left societies, now are being highly polarized, and I think we'll see a lot of conflict there. Mm-hmm. Finally, I think the situation in the Middle East is going to become more militarized. I think the double game that the West is playing of criticizing ISIS and then supplying them with arms directly or indirectly, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, U.S., and others engaged in this double game, I think we're going to see a perpetuation of instability and warfare in the Middle East. Yemen joining the PAC, dictatorships in Egypt, and a climate in which no easy road to peace and justice.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us, James Petras. And notwithstanding those past projections you made, we wish you all the best for 2016.
Yeah, I wish I could say more in a positive vein, but I think we would be fooling ourselves. We have to prepare ourselves for the long, long struggle.
James Petras is a retired Bartle Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton. He's an author. He is also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Thank you for sticking with the Global Research News Hour for the past year. We'll return again in 2016 with more regular programming.